From TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing things to say things to you on the radio instead. Joining us in the studio is Observer editor Dave Mann, who triumphantly edited all of our posts in the live blog we did on primary night Tuesday. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you.
Also with us is Observer politics writer Chris Hooks, who is enjoying cheese trays and the latest episode of The Voice while waiting for things to get rolling at Dan Patrick's campaign headquarters on Tuesday night. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, Jonathan. Thanks.
Later in the program, we'll be joined by freelance writer and frequent Observer contributor Carolyn Jones, whose story, Texas's New Abortion Law is Driving Women to Extremes, explains some of the unaccounted for problems of the 20-week abortion ban's execution. But first, we have some news to discuss. We're recording this episode just a couple of days after the primary, and good God, is there a lot to talk about. Dave, let's start with you. What, if anything, surprised you about the outcomes of the primary?
Well, I think there were some individual races that had some really surprising outcomes. But I think on the whole, kind of in the big picture, there wasn't anything kind of blow you out of the water surprising. Obviously, the big race was the primary for lieutenant governor. We had four Republicans, and it was like, you know, who can be more crazy than the other person, right? I mean, it was just like...
Is that who won, the person who was the most crazy?
Well, some people think so, yeah. I mean, Dan Patrick came in first, and I think some people would claim that, yeah, he was probably the farthest out of all the contenders. I mean, David Dewhurst has been trying to act like a Tea Party Republican, but no one's really buying that. Especially Republican primary voters, apparently. And then you had Jerry Patterson and Todd Staples, who kind of brought in third and fourth. But, you know, Dan Patrick finished first with 40-something percent, and I think that some people may have found that surprising, but I don't know if I think you're paying really close attention to the race and really close attention to Texas politics over the last 2 years. I don't think it's surprising that Dan Patrick came in first in that primary. I mean, he was making noises about challenging Dewhurst for years and finally did. And he's been, you know, one of the more popular Republican politicians, and especially among the Tea Party. And the Tea Party has all the juice right now on the Republican side. So, and Dewhurst has been just running terrible campaigns. I mean, he's like the incumbent and the favorite every time. He's got the most money. He's got the most name ID. But,
so what's going wrong?
Well, he's just kind of a terrible politician. And it's kind of unfortunate for him. But, I mean, he's been squandering the advantages of incumbency. And the reason for that is that he keeps running against these guys who are better campaigners, better politicians. I mean, Ted Cruz, Dewhurst was the favorite 2 years ago against Ted Cruz in the Senate primary. And Cruz seemingly came out of nowhere and beat Dewhurst, and that's because Cruz is a better politician. And the same thing with Dan Patrick. I mean, Dewhurst was clearly the favorite, but it didn't take a rocket scientist, I think, to see that Dan Patrick was much more beloved by the Tea Party and was kind of the better natural politician. And so when you have that combination in the Republican primary, I don't think it's surprising that Patrick was gonna come in first. Chris, I don't know what you thought of that outcome.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the surprise is that about 2 weeks out from Election Day, we had a poll from the University of Texas and the Texas Tribune. It was kind of only the indicator we had of how the race was going, and it had Dan Patrick in a solid second, pretty far away from Staples and Patterson, but also a distance from Dewhurst. And yeah, it was an election in which you had Staples, who had kind of tried to identify himself as a Christian and someone who was really tough on the border as agriculture commissioner, which didn't make a lot of sense. but yeah, Dan Patrick was just an incredibly effective campaigner, was able to tack very, very far to the right, got around Staples. And you had Patterson, who was kind of a libertarian leaning, kind of a weirdo. I mean that in an affectionate way, but yeah, Patrick is just, I guess, what people want right now. It was surprising to me a little bit that he got the margin that he did, but it was pretty convincing.
So can you tell us a little bit about what the atmosphere was like at Dan Patrick's HQ on Tuesday night?
Yeah, the notable thing for me was his certainty and the certainty of his supporters. It didn't seem like there was any doubt in his mind that he was going to be ending the election in the way that he did. I lost track of the number of times that he thanked God for his performance. in increasingly colorful language. And yeah, all of his supporters that came out felt the same way. He has a base that feels very passionately about him as the leader of a movement, and his ability to kind of take that movement forward. And I expect a lot of those people will be showing up in the runoff.
Yeah, and I was going to jump in and say, I think that gives him a huge advantage in the runoff. I mean, to get 40-something percent in a four-person field is pretty impressive. I mean, it's not enough to win. You have to get 50% to win the race outright and avoid a runoff. He didn't quite get there, but in a four-person field, all of whom were very strong candidates. I mean, you're talking about three statewide office holders and Dan Patrick, who's a state senator. So, you know, these people are all legitimate candidates with bases of support. And for Patrick to capture 40% of the vote in that kind of four-person field that's that strong is really impressive. And I think I agree with you, Chris, that, yeah, his supporters have that passion. And, you know, usually in a runoff, it's even lower turnout than the primary. And usually, like, whose ever supporters are the most passionate is going to win. And I think right now you'd have to say that's probably Dan Patrick.
So how do you think we'll see Dewhurst changing up his strategy in anticipation of the runoff? Or maybe we won't. I mean, what do you think?
Well, I think Dewhurst, you know, he's in a tough spot. And I think psychologically it's hard not to look back at the Ted Cruz race at this point, where him and Cruz were in a runoff and Dewhurst got clobbered. So, I mean, I think Dewhurst probably has to try to attack Patrick here because Patrick's the favorite, and I would assume he'd want to attack Dan Patrick. There have been some revelations just in the last few weeks of the primary about Dan Patrick, you know, possibly hiring illegal immigrants for his businesses back in the 80s. And obviously, if you're hiring undocumented people and you're running in a Republican primary, that's not usually good news. But it didn't really seem to hurt Dan Patrick. I don't know what if the revelations came out too late or people just didn't believe it. But there's certainly material there that maybe wasn't entirely fleshed out and Dewhurst could probably seize on. And if he wanted to kind of get some attack ads to bring down Dan Patrick's margin. I mean, the other issue is what's going to happen with Staples and Jerry Patterson, who are now out of the race. And sometimes if people who've lost the primary throw their support to one of the other two, that can sometimes swing the runoff. So Staples is making noises like he's not going to endorse anybody, which hurts Dewhurst. Patterson's made clear he's not going to endorse Dan Patrick. There's a lot of animosity there. Maybe Jerry Patterson would endorse Dewhurst. And if he did, that certainly would help Dewhurst. So I would say maybe trying to bring Patrick down a peg, number one, and number two, seeing if you can secure an endorsement from either Staples or Patterson.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously going to be a very different electorate in the runoff. But if you just look at the numbers, Staples and Patterson comprised about 30% of the votes. And for Dewhurst to pick up 22% of that or more is a pretty hefty hurdle for him. So, yeah, he's going to need to make himself a lot more appealing to conservatives. He's going to need to drag down Dan Patrick. He's going to need a lot. It may not be possible to do for him.
And the other thing that we kind of have to start thinking about is if it works out as people are predicting and Dan Patrick becomes lieutenant governor, and obviously there's a runoff and obviously there's a general election and we've got Letitia Van de Putters running on the Democratic side. And there's definitely Democrats out there who think if Dan Patrick is the Republican nominee, the Democrats have a better chance. But if it all works out as some people are predicting and Dan Patrick becomes lieutenant governor, I mean, that represents a serious change in Texas politics. I mean, Dan Patrick is straight out of the Tea Party. You know, he's got some pretty severe positions on immigration and cracking down on the border. He's against abortion in all circumstances. He's very pro-voucher, pro-charter schools, kind of really wants to severely restrict state spending. So I think it'd be good for us in the press. I mean, Dan Patrick is good for a quote, if nothing, you know, but in terms of policy for Texas, and then you look at, you know, the number of Tea Party candidates that won in primaries for the Texas Senate. I mean, you could have, we were talking before, you could have three or four new Tea Party senators in the Texas Senate in a body that was already kind of drifting rightward, you know, and add in Dan Patrick as lieutenant governor, and you've got a very right-wing flavor in the Texas Senate, which, you know, is, I would think, pretty alarming for anybody of a different political persuasion.
Yeah, I think even maybe more noticeable than Dan Patrick's individual policy positions is the fact that he's militantly against compromise in the Senate. He's said time and time again that he would do away with the Senate's two-thirds rule, which is, in the past, you need two-thirds of the chamber to bring up a bill for a vote, and that's always kind of assisted the Senate Democrats to bring concessions on legislation that they don't like. And he's also really hit Dewhurst hard for appointing Democrats as committee chairs in the Senate. And that's something that's really kind of been important in bringing more bipartisan flavor to the process. In the past, the Senate has been a check on some things that conservatives wanted but couldn't bring through the legislature. And with Dan Patrick in control and a number of these other new senators, I think you would see that dramatically change.
Yeah, it's quite a change. I mean, I remember when Dan Patrick was first elected, and his first day in the Texas Senate was in 2007. And he gets in there and he was railing against the two-thirds rule because the Democrats had used the two-thirds rule to block a lot of these conservative bills. And he proposes changing the two-thirds rule, right, which this, you know, august body, the Texas Senate, is not going to go for. And he gets outvoted 31-1. And, you know, people were kind of laughing at him in the Capitol. I mean, it's kind of a joke. But people probably should have been paying more attention because that was like – that was like a foothold, you know, for what would become the Tea Party. And slowly but surely, more and more Tea Party people have been elected to the Senate. Now Dan Patrick could become lieutenant governor. And I agree, Chris, like, bye-bye two-thirds rule, bye-bye Democrats as committee chairs. I mean, you know, and they've got some of the longest-serving committee, like John Whitmire, you know, heads the Criminal Justice Committee. I mean, we're talking radical changes in the legislature if these results hold up.
So we heard from Dave about something he found a little bit surprising. Chris, I was wondering if there were any races that you found particularly surprising or interesting.
As far as the Senate side, there were a number of races between moderate Republicans and Tea Partiers that I thought maybe one or two would flip in the moderate direction, and it seemed like none of them did. You had John Corona in Dallas, who's been a kind of a longtime establishment senator, who's been conservative, but he's also been open on issues like payday lending reform and a number of other kind of important things he's been the leader on. And he got knocked out in a very close margin by a guy named Don Huffines, who's kind of an acolyte of Ron Paul and is this very ideological figure. You had Donna Campbell, the Tea Party leader, win re-election after a pretty rocky session with no problem. And you have Connie Burton, up in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, who may replace Wendy Davis and the only seat to change party alignment this cycle. And she's obviously very different from Wendy Davis.
Yeah, I thought the success of the Tea Party was in the Senate was certainly noteworthy. I mean, after last session, I don't think a lot of people thought Donna Campbell was coming back, and looks like she's coming back. And then, yeah, Connie Burton is in a runoff with Mark Shelton in Wendy Davis's district. But she's certainly the favorite. Connie Burton is the favorite there. Corona lost. One big surprise I thought was Senator Bob Dole in Dallas was forced into a runoff with a Tea Party opponent. And Bob Dole is pretty conservative, but apparently they found somebody further right than him. And I didn't think that race was up for grabs. So that's surprising. So I thought we'll see what happens in that runoff. But potentially you've got Wendy Davis and Tommy Williams and John Corona all being replaced by, and those are moderate, you know, moderate to center right voices in the Senate being replaced by Tea Party members, at least three and maybe four. So we're seeing definitely a rightward shift in the Senate. Although I was saying in the House is much more of a mixed bag. I mean, the Tea Party tried to go after, you know, Joe Strauss, the speaker, again. They tried to go after some of Strauss's lieutenants, and, you know, they won a couple but lost a few. And we certainly saw some Republican moderates, Representative J.D. Sheffield, who's a doctor who ran originally as kind of on a pro-education, pro-healthcare platform in the Republican primary. He was reelected. So, you know, you certainly have moderate, more moderate voices in the House that were successful. So I think much more of a mixed bag in the Texas House. And if the Senate is going further right, the House is definitely staying in the center. So, yeah, the Senate used to be the check, right, in the Texas legislature. And now that's flipped. And the House is going to have to moderate things even more so now, with the Senate seem to be like drifting further right.
And also in terms of surprises, you saw a couple of statewide candidates who were maybe supposed to come in second and then enter a runoff, come in first. You had Ken Paxton, who would be a very conservative attorney general, almost escape a runoff, winning his primary. I think he had 44% or something like that. You had Sid Miller, who's a kind of this cowboy hat wearing caricature, whose campaign treasurer is Ted Nugent, and whose eyes kind of glaze over when he talks about agriculture issues, win the agriculture commissioner primary. Just a kind of, a number of races where people who were supposed to have a chance, conservatives, just dominate.
Dave, I know you were looking at Glenn Hager's battle pretty closely. Did he actually avoid the runoff, or?
It's not quite clear at this point. He's come within, like, you know, a hair of avoiding the runoff. Basically got to, you know, you have to get to 50% to avoid the runoff. And he was basically standing at 49.99%. So technically now I think, yeah, probably heading for a runoff, but you know, you can recount a few votes and look at the margins. I mean, it's literally down to a few dozen votes, I think, separating him from getting to that 50% barrier. I think that was a surprise that Glenn Hager, who's a state senator, you know, running for comptroller, one, that he came in first, because, you know, the Texas Tribune poll didn't show that. The Texas Tribune poll had Deborah Medina, the kind of Tea Party favorite, in first, and Glenn Hager in third. Of course, those results in the primary were actually flipped. Not only that Glenn Hager came in first, I think it was a little surprising, but also that he almost won it outright. I mean, to win it outright in a four-person field, another four-person field, is really impressive. And Harvey Hildebrand is in second. He's a state rep. So it looks like now they may be, Glenn Hager may be just a little short, but I think that's still totally, you know, the technicalities of it to be worked out. I don't know if I've ever seen somebody come that close to a runoff. So it's got to be a little tough for the Glenn Hager campaign to be so close to avoiding the time and effort and money to go through a runoff. But obviously you'd have to like his chances if he does get into it.
Well, guys, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
Thanks.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. If you're a regular listener to the show, you know that we've devoted a lot of airtime to talking about Texas's anti-abortion bill from the last legislative session and the consequences it has had for Texas women since going into effect. Joining me now in the studio is freelance writer and frequent Observer contributor Carolyn Jones, whose story, Texas's new abortion law is driving women to extremes, explains some of the minute details in a section of the law banning abortions after 20 weeks that are puzzling at best and heart-wrenching at worst. Carolyn, can you tell us a little bit about Sarah Guler?
Yeah. Sarah Guler is a Houston mom. She lives in suburban Houston. Last fall, she discovered that she was pregnant with her third child. She and her husband were delighted. It was an unexpected pregnancy, and they were delighted to be adding to their family. When she went for her standard 19-week ultrasound, which is the one where the doctor makes sure that the physical anatomy of the fetus is healthy, when she went for that standard doctor's appointment, she discovered that the fetus had a severe anomaly, one that the doctor described was incompatible with life. Now, as you can imagine, this was a very shocking and unexpected diagnosis for Sarah and her husband. And I should point out, Sarah Guler is not her real name. She asked us to protect her anonymity, giving her this name. And she asked her doctor if there's anything that could be done to improve the fetus's health. And the doctor said nothing could be done. And she then asked, the doctor then suggested that, you know, her only alternative really was to terminate the pregnancy, when she asked whether the doctor could schedule an early induction for her at one of the specialist hospitals in Houston, the doctor said, "We can't help you. We don't do that here." And he furnished her with a list of abortion clinics.
Right.
And he said, "But you only have a week because you're at 19 weeks. There's a new ban, but bans abortions at 20 weeks. So by next Friday, it will be too late. You need to get that appointment immediately." So even though Sarah and her husband were reeling from this shocking diagnosis,
right,
they had to call around and try and get an appointment. But it was just days before Christmas, and many of the abortion clinics were closed for Christmas. Others only provide abortions up to 16 weeks. And she discovered that there were no clinics in her area, and in fact, there were no clinics in Texas that could take her and terminate the pregnancy before the 20-week cutoff. So she and her husband ended up going to Little Rock Clinic in Arkansas, which is the only abortion clinic in Arkansas, and they were able to schedule her for an abortion at just a few days after Christmas. The second problem that she and her husband had was that they did not have the cash to pay for this procedure. It cost $3,500.
Right.
And she and her husband are on Medicaid. They had to borrow money to fix up their car to make the long drive from suburban Houston to Little Rock. Her husband had to take time off work. The clinic in Little Rock was able to discount the cost of the procedure by half because she was on Medicaid. But nonetheless, they still had to throw in their January rent money in order to cover the cost of the procedure. On the way out of town, on the way to Little Rock, Sarah stopped at a pawn shop and pawned her wedding ring in exchange for enough cash to pay for the procedure, the travel costs, and the accommodation when she was there. When she and her husband arrived, it was about a 10-hour journey, which they did overnight. They were swarmed by protesters at the clinic who said things like, "Don't harm your baby. You don't know what your baby could become." Which Sarah described as deeply traumatic.
Because, of course, she knew exactly what it could become.
That's right. She had tried desperately to find a way to save the pregnancy or to, you know, if it were possible, to improve the fetus's health, but there was no option. So she didn't want to be there, certainly, and it was very traumatic for her to then be crowded by these people. The procedure took 2 days because at that time in your pregnancy, it does take much longer. The recommendation is that you then rest, have bed rest, because,
sure,
but they couldn't. She couldn't do that because they couldn't afford another night's accommodation. So she had to get in the car and drive all the way back home in an enormous amount of physical and emotional pain. Sarah spoke to me a few days after the procedure happened, because she was trying to find a way to understand what had happened with this law and to cover the costs as well, because she and her husband had now fallen into a great amount of debt in order to pay for this procedure. And that's how she came to me.
So one of the sections in your story actually lists several of the questions that Sarah had. I'm going to share that with our listeners real quick. Section begins, "If lawmakers had banned abortion after 20 weeks, why didn't they tell doctors to perform the detailed ultrasound earlier so that pregnant women have time to make a decision?" She'd read the law itself and found an exemption for severe fetal abnormalities. Why hadn't her doctor known this? What can you tell us about that?
That's right. Well, for the first question, Sarah had known nothing about this law. She hadn't been following politics of the last legislative session, so it was a true shock to her. So now she said to me quite reasonably, "Well, if they're going to ban abortions at 20 weeks, this anatomy scan that every pregnant woman has should come forward." I spoke to Dr. Moss Hampton, who heads up the College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists in Texas, to ask him if it's possible to move that scan forward so that pregnant women don't end up in this kind of situation.
Right, that makes sense.
And he replied to me that it's technically not possible to do that because the scan is done at 20 weeks between 18 and 22 weeks, because that's when the fetus is large enough to be seen on the ultrasound screen and for them to be able to do the sort of the correct anatomical scan. So if they moved it forward, they wouldn't be able to get as clear a picture as they need. So for purely physical and technical reasons, it's not possible to move that forward. Onto the second question about the exceptions, Sarah had Googled the text of the law itself, which is House Bill 2, and found the text, and it's written sort of very turgid, legalistic language, and there was some reference to exceptions for severe fetal abnormalities. When I asked Dr. Moss-Hampton from the College of Obstetricians about this, he said he himself had not been aware of any exceptions until we'd spoken. And when he went and looked at the law and read the terminology, he said that, yes, there are some exceptions. And when I told him about the specific diagnosis that Sarah Gula had been given, he confirmed that this would have fallen within the exemption category.
So one of the things that struck me about this story is that it seems that doctors themselves aren't totally aware of the law, obviously. They don't know about these exemptions. Who's responsible for educating them on that, and how is that being implemented?
Ordinarily, it would be the Department of State Health Services who, in a case like this, who would be responsible for issuing guidance about new laws and detailed information about how providers might go about implementing the laws. I checked with the Department of State Health Services. They said they did not issue any guidance to obstetricians or gynecologists or to abortion providers in Texas, and they explained that the law was self-implementing. I confess I'm not really sure what that means, but I think what the Department of State Health Services was implying was that if they wanted to understand the law, they could go and read it themselves. But as I said, the law itself is written in, you know, impenetrable language of any statute. You would need a law degree, I think, to be able to understand it in its, to be able to read this with confidence. Busy health practitioners do not have time to be reading the laws of statutes. And moreover, even if they did have time to be wading through this for all of these different laws that affect their patients, the wording of House Bill 2 is not written by medical practitioners. It's copycat language written by anti-abortion groups, national anti-abortion groups, and it is very vague. And so when it talks about severe, when it talks about fetal abnormalities, it doesn't really clarify that. So because there is no legal clarity about what an exception might be, your ordinary physician, quite understandably, is risk averse in interpreting it them for themselves, because this is a very hostile climate in Texas, and they're, you know, afraid of prosecution, quite understandably, when they're acting within the sort of the fuzziness of the legal world when it comes to anti-abortion bills.
So we're recording this interview on Thursday, March 6th, and we got some news today that actually two more clinics have closed. Can you tell me about the significance of that?
That's right. So House Bill 2, which passed last summer, one arm of it was this 20-week abortion ban, which is actually, it's actually 22 weeks of gestation, not 20 weeks, but that's a different point. So there are four arms to it: the 20-week abortion ban, restrictions on medication abortions, the requirement that all abortion doctors have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals, and the also a requirement that all abortion facilities upgrade their facilities in line with ambulatory surgical care centers. Now, in October, three aspects of that law went into effect: the 20-week ban, the medication abortion restrictions, and the admitting privileges. Overnight, 14 abortion clinics closed because these clinics were unable to get the admitting privileges at the local hospitals that they required for numerous bureaucratic reasons. And so before the bill started, we had 36 abortion clinics across Texas. Overnight, October 31st, we lost 14. We just heard that today we lost two more abortion clinics, one in the Rio Grande Valley and one in East Texas in Beaumont, which now takes the number down to 20 abortion clinics across Texas. And there are now no more abortion clinics in rural parts of Texas.
Which means that people would have to drive into urban centers if they don't live there.
That's right. We're talking about hundreds of miles round trip for many women, many of whom will be low-income women or women who will not be able to get time off work, who have other children. And so finding childcare in order for them to make these mammoth distances, these are real barriers that are being thrown up.
Well, Carolyn, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, visit us on the web at texasobserver.org or pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk at you again next time on Observer Radio.